Case number 84724, Trejo versus State. Are the parties ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. All right. Counsel, are you going to want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Can I get like 5 minutes?
Sure. So just so we're clear, when it gets to 5 minutes, then the old light will come on. You'll hear a tone, but the clock still keeps running down to zero as long as you're still standing there.
Gotcha.
All right. Go ahead.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is William Waters. I'm with Clark County Public Defender's Office, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Mario Trejo. We've identified a number of issues that occurred in the proceedings below, both prior to and during trial, which we believe deprived Mr. Trejo of his fundamental right, due process right to a fair trial and warrant reversal. I want to start with the interpreter, or the lack of the interpreter. Now, I'm sure you've read the briefs and are familiar. Mr. Trejo suffered a medical incident while incarcerated at the Clark County Detention Center, which resulted in the loss of his ability to speak. That was apparent at a number of pretrial proceedings while he was represented by the public defender's office prior to the Feretta Canvas. At one point, he became disillusioned with his attorney and decided that he wanted either a new attorney to represent himself. And at that point, I think it's the clear part of the record where the court is now. If the court wasn't on notice prior to that, at that point, the court was certainly on notice that there was a problem with his ability to communicate. I think that the statutes at issue here, NRS 50-051 and then the other ones as well, are mandatory. So once I think the court is aware that there's a communications disability, the statutes use mandatory language, must, shall, appoint an interpreter to help this person in all proceedings going forward.
Mr. Waters, can I just stop you there for
sure.
A moment? In talking about those statutes, it defines interpreter in terms of registered community interpreter, which is defined as a sign language interpreter,
correct,
which doesn't seem to be exactly what you're looking for. So how does the statute actually apply?
Well, so I think it talks about a person. The statutes say that you're entitled to interpreter if you have a communications disability.
Yeah.
And a communications disability is a physical speaking impairment, which I think we all agree Mr. Trejo had. Now,
yeah,
the legislature, for whatever reason, you know, was probably only thinking in terms of people who are deaf or mute, but I think the language is broad enough, at least with respect to who's entitled to one, to cover someone like Mr. Trejo. Now, is it ideal that you have a sign language interpreter in this situation? You know, I don't know. There might be someone better or worse. I don't know. But I think that's what the legislature said. So I think we have to follow the strict reading of the statute, and that's what he was entitled to.
A sign language interpreter.
And I think, you know, sign language interpreters, I think, have different skill sets than, say, a foreign language interpreter. And maybe there was, you know, I think the statute was pretty plain, so I didn't really go into legislative history to understand why they chose to sort of limit it this way or to assign it this way. But
there's nothing that says that your client could even follow a sign language exchange, correct?
Right. So the sign language interpreter, had that person been appointed, probably wouldn't be like using signs, but they would be reading whatever he would write or repeating what he would maybe whisper to the court. Now, that said, you know, there's a sort of escape
hatch. But
orally. Orally, correct.
And under oath.
Important point. And there's an escape hatch, if I can use that term, which is, you know, if one is not readily available, you can appoint someone else after you do a voir dire and have them go through the oath as well. So, you know, there were options that the court had here. But the important point is the court was on notice that something had to be done. And nothing was done at that point. I think Mr. Schwartzer, in the record, agreed that this was a problem, that he couldn't communicate properly. Nothing was done.
Well, the court allowed the...
Oh, well, correct. I mean, that was done. You're right. Your Honor's correct. The court allowed the CEO, because this was during COVID, so he was over at the jail during his court appearances on blue jeans.
So his guard or what?
His jailer was basically his interpreter. Now, the reason why that's significant is because elsewhere in the statutes, it talks about the interpreter's role is sort of like you're kind of on the same level at that point. So you have a lot of privileges as the interpreter. In fact, if you look at NRS 49027, a person who has a privilege against the disclosure of a matter may prevent the disclosure of that matter by an interpreter to whom the matter was disclosed merely to facilitate a privileged communication of the matter. So this is an important relationship. This isn't...
It makes no sense to have the jailer be the interpreter, is what you're saying.
Absolutely.
Consistent with the statute, but neither does a sign language person. Are you saying this is reversible error or structural error?
So the way I read it, now, again, we don't have any analogous cases. I think I pointed that out. I looked very hard for a situation that was sort of similar to what I've got here. And the closest I could find would be cases involving deaf defendants and so forth. But the only thing we have in Nevada, which would be binding, is the foreign language case. And really the only one is Tun. Now, the problem with Tun is it doesn't help us very much because, so this court has said you have a due process right to an interpreter if you need one. And
and that was pre-statutory or not?
I'll take your word for it. I don't know. So they said it's an abuse of discretion standard whether the court should appoint one or not. But then it says, you know, we analyze it for abuse of discretion and clear error. So if my reading of that, there's no talk of harmlessness, is that if there's an error that occurred and it's clear, then the due process rights are violated and we get a reversal. Now, Tun, ultimately, they looked at the record and they said, you know, there was no abuse of discretion because, you know, and there's not much factual information in that decision, but I'm assuming that based on the record,
this was all pretrial. From trial forward, he had a qualified interpreter, albeit a foreign language interpreter, but yeah, one that nonetheless was independent and subject to privileges,
right,
and so
yeah,
on.
Yeah, I'm not going to disparage the foreign language. They do tremendous.
So you're talking all pretrial.
But, well, I think strictly speaking, there wasn't conformance with the statute, even if the statute doesn't make a lot of sense to us, because a foreign language interpreter is not necessarily a registered community interpreter. That said.
But they're under oath, or they.
They do very good work, and I'm not necessarily disputing that, you know, they were incapable of doing it. But I do think a jailer, a guard, is not the person that you're going to use, much less appoint. I mean, there was no appointment here. It's more, you know, just go ahead and just, you know.
I found you and you do it. Yeah.
Right. Like, let's just pull anyone who's. And given this relationship between interpreters and the defendant, you know, and the importance of that and the fact that privileges apply and so forth, it's analogous to say, I need an attorney because I'm indigent. The public defender's not available. Let's just pull someone out of the audience, whether you're licensed or not. I think you do a good job. I think this is, you know, this is just a summary proceeding that, you know, doesn't require a lot of legal knowledge. So I'm going to go ahead and appoint this person to represent you in this proceeding. I think the court would have a real problem with that. And I don't know.
I think we got a little off track on whether this is structural error or not. Could you maybe go back to that?
So the problem, I'm going to assert that it's structural error only because, again, without clear guidance from this court through prior case law saying that this is subject to a harmless analysis, what the court has said is in these situations, now, albeit that was a foreign language interpreter, the failure to provide one when required, is clear error. So, you know, we reverse. Your due process rights were violated.
How do you think it plays in that he was able to, because unlike the foreign language context, he was able to understand what was going on. He could hear and perceive what was going on. It was more an issue with his ability to communicate.
So I think you're right. And I don't think there's anything in the record that suggests he didn't understand the proceedings. He spoke English, whatever. But the problem is, so let's get to the FREDA canvas. And I think that's sort of like the clearest example of where this communication problem like rears its head. In Miles, this court said, FREDA is a conversation. Right. Without an interpreter present, without the devoting the sort of the time necessary, given the circumstances here, he's either writing out short statements that the jailer is reading, or he's like giving a thumbs up or a thumbs down, or he's holding up a piece of paper that says yes or no. And again, in Miles, this court said FREDA is a conversation. And although there's no, I guess, formula, you know, if you look at the totality of the circumstances, was this a conversation? You know, not, it was, it couldn't be. Given the fact that the court didn't, number one, appoint someone, some independent person to interpret for him or to at least read for him, and didn't, you know, maybe set aside, like, you know, the time that would, I mean, I understand, like, district courts are very busy and they don't necessarily
want to call. Well, counsel, at least the second Feretta canvas, which was the post-Miles canvas, it's my understanding that it went so long, it was finishing one day and then continued the next day. And it's my understanding was a total of about 2.5 hours. Is that incorrect?
I'm going to answer this last question before I then say the rest of my bro. You're probably right. I'll take your word for it. But that could have been just the asking a question, waiting for him to write an answer. And then, uh-huh. I mean, so that could have added sort of the time. I wasn't at the trial. Mr. Schwarzer might be better able to answer that question. But yeah, I think that some of the delay might have been just in logistics, right? Like, he's over at the jail, he's writing something out, or...
Right, but does he allege that there was some misunderstanding he had in the Feretta canvas, something he wrote down that the CO didn't read properly, or, I mean...
No, I mean...
What's the harm?
I don't know if we have to worry about the harm, quite frankly, given the limited right. case law that we have. I do think it's probably structural. I'm going to assert that it is structural, but if you're asking me as an academic experience, like, where's the harm, then I would agree with you that there's nothing in the record to suggest that there was some sort of, like, I wrote X and then he said Y. Like, I agree that the record doesn't disclose that. I'm not saying that that didn't happen. I'm just, honestly, that's not in the record.
Or that there's something else he wanted to say but didn't have time to write or anything like that.
Well, I do think that there is a moment where the judge admonishes him, there's no need to write a novel. Like, I'm busy here.
I don't think that was during that hearing.
No, it,
but
well,
I could
right.
be mistaken.
You're right. It wasn't. But
it, yeah, during one of the hearings, there
right.
was some conversation to that effect.
I mean, this was during COVID. So, you know, everything was being done, I guess, you know, remotely and so forth. And I think not a lot of trials were going, cases were being dealt. So I think the district courts were very busy. And I think the sentiment that I get in reading the transcripts was there was, maybe annoyance isn't the right word, but sort of a, you know, this is kind of taking, you know, this is taking up a lot of my calendar.
Yeah.
And although, you know, if Your Honor is correct that this, so the second Feretta canvas was, you know, I guess more time consuming, I'll concede that, but I do think that it doesn't necessarily affect the adequacy of it, which I didn't even get to in my rebuttal time. So I'm going to take a seat.
Okay. Mr. Schwarzer.
Good afternoon, this honorable court. Michael Schwarzer, the state of Nevada. I was actually the trial attorney in this case. Mm-hmm. So I want to start with where Mr. Waters ended, which is regarding this interpreter with the Feretta canvas. I will point out that the Feretta canvas was a special setting. It wasn't actually during the calendar. It did go 2+ hours and we followed Miles religiously. I think Judge Ballou actually did a fantastic job of being through that opinion and going kind of step through step on it, including Mr. Trejo was able to give significant answers when it came to what is cross-examination, what is voir dire, what is mitigation evidence. There were a lot of yes or no questions, I'll agree with that, but there were also general questions that were asked. Additionally, when we talked about elements of the crime and they were slightly wrong, not only did Judge Blue, but also the state itself, I think at that point it was Mr. Evans, because I had to go run to a different courtroom, pointing out we just wanted to inform Mr. Trejo that he got some of the elements wrong. And Mr. Trejo's response is, I know how to research, and I've done this civilly before, and therefore I think we follow Miles very well. So I don't think there's any issues with the Feretta canvas, which by the way, went for 4 days. We had 4 days of a Feretta canvas with this individual where the judge went thoroughly into all the things that you would want a Feretta canvas. I honestly don't know what else more we could have done with the Feretta canvas. Now, regarding the issue that was spent most of the time on, which is the community interpreter, Mr. Trejo isn't an individual that does sign language. He's an individual that speaks English. He might speak other languages as well, but he speaks English. He could communicate.
Well, sorry. He has a communication disability, though. You agree with
he
that?
He does have a communication disability. I agree. He can whisper. He talked to me plenty during the trial. So it's not that he's completely incapable of talking, but he can whisper, but the whisper isn't loud enough in order to actually present to a jury. And I want to be very clear, I would have loved to have an attorney on this case. This was Mr. Trejo's decision to do a Feretta canvas. I think the fact that Mr. Trejo decided to do his own defense, extend the trial a lot longer than it should have been, and raises issues that brings us in front of this court. So I would have, very frankly, would have loved to have Mr. Henry stay on that case. But obviously, Mr. Trejo has his right to self-representation, and he chose to do so. Now, regarding the error here, I don't think it violates his due process. Toms talks about it's a Thai interpreter, it's a Thai language, and I agree with Mr. Waters, it's a very brief decision. But they said, if you don't understand what's going on in this courtroom, then obviously what's even the point of the defendant being in the courtroom?
Right. But so, I mean, that case is about when the judge determines that somebody communicates in English well enough that they don't need an interpreter, right?
Correct.
So here we have somebody who qualifies under the statute for an interpreter, but isn't given one. So isn't that a little bit different situation?
I agree. It's a different situation. I believe it really the right analysis on it is harmless error. I don't think there was a due process violation because there is no claim by the defense here that he didn't understand the proceedings that was going on.
So how do we evaluate harmless error, though, when we're looking at something that happened pre-trial and is completely unrelated to the facts of the case?
So that's a great question. I think it's basically the way that questions were asked to my opposing counsel here, which is what would have made a difference having an attorney there? There was nothing on the record that indicates that Mr. Trejo didn't say the things he wanted to say in those pre-trials. And if you look at some of those pre-trial arguments, he actually spends about a page, you know, he writes it out ahead of time and spends about a page having it read off to the court. There is no allegation here at all that anything would have been different if he actually had a sign language interpreter pre-trial. During trial, nothing would have been different if he had sign language interpreter, because again, he doesn't speak in sign language. He speaks in English. He wrote everything down in English, and then the court appointed interpreter, at least at trial, was saying what was said. Same thing was said with the correction officers. Now, could have been better. Could have been better to have someone besides the correction officer. Absolutely, but we're talking about during the COVID era, during the blue jeans, where interpreters weren't actually in the same room as the defendants. And so at the end of the day, you need someone who can actually read the cards or read what he's writing down. He would come in, Mr. Trejo would come in with pages of things to read to the court, and the corrections officer would read it. Would I have preferred to have an interpreter do it? Absolutely. But considering the era that we're talking about, which is the COVID era, I don't think we could have done anything differently than what we did. And again, if you go under a harmless error, or even if you think this is structural, and he waived, because there was never an objection to it. In fact, he waived his appellate rights to this specific claim in the beginning of the trial.
I don't know that I necessarily agree with that. Don't you think that the court has an affirmative obligation to ensure that the people who are in the courtroom can communicate?
I do, and I think the judge did that in this case. I think she had the correction officers read. There was never a time where the correction officer rejected reading off what Mr. Trejo was saying. There was never a time where Mr. Trejo was told not to keep, you know, writing whatever he was writing.
She didn't follow the statute, which is fairly clear.
I don't disagree with you on that. But I think either if you do the harmless error standard, or even if you do the plain error standard, because again, there was no, at the very least, there was no objection to this at during the pretrial or during the trial, correct?
Let's talk about that. Okay. So at some point, Mr. Trejo filed a motion specifically asking for an interpreter. And there was one hearing, apparently, where there was an interpreter and he had some sort of a typewriter, and the person to read his written statements was there. This is one pretrial hearing.
Right.
And during that hearing, it's my understanding Mr. Trejo said, well, he recovered some of his voice and he didn't actually use the interpreter. Like, can you, I guess, what happened there and going forward? Like, why was there an interpreter that time and not in future hearings?
I believe at that time we were actually back in court. So that he was actually physically in court speaking from the box where the custodies are.
Yes.
I know you're familiar with that, but just for the record.
Yes.
So that my understanding of is that is he, it was actually I saw that actually reviewing materials this week. My understanding is that was not during Blue Jeans and he was physically present there. And then, you know, so it's different than the previous Freda campuses where we had to get special settings through at the time Department 7 in order to do Blue Jeans for that special setting. And again, we used the full time in the in both cases in order to do the proper Freda campus. So even if we do a plain error analysis, I don't think there could be any argument that any substantive rights were violated in this.
Like, but if we're saying, if you're arguing, and I think you are, that he didn't object to not having an interpreter, wasn't his filing of the motion such an objection?
Filing the motion to have, well,
to have an interpreter. Like, so he actually wrote something and filed it asking to have an interpreter.
In order to communicate to the jury. So that this specific motion wasn't like, I haven't been able to communicate to the court. This specific motion was in order to better communicate with the jury based on the fact that he can't speak above a whisper. He wanted to have an interpreter there, which we did not oppose, nor should we oppose. So I would not consider that an objection. And once again, I understand that this court isn't inclined, or at least Justice Bell is not inclined to say that he waived his appellate right, but we did go.
What would be the basis? He wasn't entering a plea of guilty. Like, the state didn't even have all that was happening was that as part of him representing himself, it was being made clear to him that what the expectations were, but like, what would be the basis for the state even having the ability to ask him to waive his appellate right?
I think it's the ability to continue on as his own attorney, right? If he's saying that he doesn't have the ability to communicate to the...
Well, he's legally entitled to do that.
I agree. If you're able to communicate to the jury, there's still ways in which, I understand with Retta, we have this strong push to, if someone wants to represent themselves, they should be able to. We're not fighting that. But at the end of the day, if you're not able to communicate to the jury or... you know, because of his communication issues, then I think that's what he's basically, I think we re-examine whether he should be reappointed an attorney at that point. So in order to continue going forward with what he has, because we saw this issue coming. Like, it's not like this was a surprise to us that this issue was coming, because it is a very unique situation. I have my 14 years of prosecuting, have never dealt with an individual who hasn't been able to speak above a whisper. And earlier on in the case, he was able to speak just fine for the first 2 months until that December surgery that he had on his throat. So I've never had that situation before. So we were all dealing with a unique, everyone, the court, myself, standby counsel, everyone was dealing with this unique situation. And we were just trying to handle it the best way we can in order to ensure that Mr. Trejo gets his constitutional right to represent himself. Right. And this was the best we can do, was get an interpreter who at the trial read everything that Mr. Trejo said, which once again, there's never been an allegation pre-trial or post-trial or during trial that Mr. Trejo's words were ever misconstrued or was ever limited. So the interpreters and the corrections officers all did it properly. So therefore, I don't think you can get past harmless error. And I don't think you can get past, if you don't believe this is a harmless error situation, I don't think you get past plain error. Regarding the Freda campus, I've already talked about that a bit.
But there's is now saying that he interprets the interpreter issue to be structural error. I didn't read the brief that way. I thought it was the structural error went to the Freda campus. But could you comment on that?
Sure. First off, my understanding is if you don't object to structural error, you still go to plain error analysis. I still don't think it's structural. So I still think I think the state could still secede on the plain error analysis in this case, because again, there's no rights that were violated based on the fact that you had a correction officer and a court appointed interpreter. But I still don't see this as a due process issue, because again, Mr. Trejo understood everything that was being said in court, being done in court. So there's no actual structure issue regarding the way the court went about this trial or even a pretrial that would have violated any type of his due process rights. So I still believe
that pretrial anyway. I think the point is that he didn't have a sworn interpreter who was and the very harmless the difficulty in finding that this impacted anything itself should weigh in favor of structural error. I think that's the argument that Mr. Waters is making, that you have a statute that says you get a sworn one. I get that it's a sign language interpreter, but set that aside. He's making the case for it being structural, which was not something that I saw in the briefs, but I want to understand why you think it is or is not structural.
I don't believe it's structural because I don't think it goes into the due process rights of this defendant. I think Mr. Trejo was able to communicate with the court. I think the fact that he did so sometimes with a sign that the judge would read, and sometimes he would do it with a corrections officer that was reading what was being said to him, doesn't impact how he can communicate with his limitations to the court, or how the court runs the trial or the pretrials. So I don't think anything
he's
that
he's trying to represent himself. I mean, that's very difficult. So if he's not able to communicate authentically through an interpreter who's sworn to be faithful in how they report what he's writing or whispering, how do we assess that?
I mean, we assess that there was nothing, there's no allegations that anything was said by the corrections officer when they were reading his writing that was any different than what he would have represented to the court.
Okay.
And he came in with prepared arguments. He came in with pages written and handed off to the correction officer, or sometimes would literally hold it up for Judge Blue to read.
How do we know that? Or is that something that's on the video of the?
It's on the Blue Jeans videos. Okay. It's on the during, and you can kind of see if you read through like the Freda canvases, some of the pretrials, you can see kind of the judge interacting with him that way as well. Talking about holding up. Sometimes she says, "I can't see you anymore," because he's kind of a shorter guy. So there's times where you can tell just from the interaction on the transcripts that Judge Blue is looking at something that's being shown on the Blue Jeans. So that's how I would answer that question. Another thing I would want to point out in my 45 seconds here is that during the Freda canvas itself, if we want to talk about the videos real quick, during the Freda canvas itself, I did ask, if you look at the February 3rd canvas, does Mr. Trejo, do you have all the discovery? He answered he did, except for some photographs. And then I provide those photographs. The receipt of copy is in our record. So he did have all the videos at the time. And in fact, I did respond, despite what was said in the brief and the reply by the defense, I did respond to his allegations that he tried to talk to me over the phone regarding those videos.
Couldn't he have been like, isn't there some way that even standby counsel could have gone down there with the videos and shown them to him in an attorney room or something?
During the representation, the standby counsel said he did show him the helicopter video, which is the big video, the main video in this case. And he did show him the first responder videos, which are, again, the big videos in this case. At the end of the day, it was just and he did say he showed him some of the pawn store videos.
Right.
There's some he had technical violations, technical issues with. By the end of the day, we had 10 witnesses from inside the pawn shop. So it's really the helicopter video that matters. And that was clearly said by Mr. Henry on the record that he was shown that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Waters.
Thank you. There's no way I'm going to be able to get to everything I'd love to get to at this point with only 2 minutes and 45 seconds. But so with respect to standby counsel, just picking up off that.
Yeah.
Standby counsel is not defined by statute. It's not defined by case law.
Uh-huh.
The court can appoint one, has discretion to do so, but it can also like limit his role. And in this case, the judge said he's not going to be your assistant. So respectfully, right. When Mr. Schwartzer, when the Freda canvas goes through and now he is the prosecuting attorney against the defendant who is acting as his own attorney, the same ethical rules apply, the same statutory rules with respect to discovery apply to him.
Yeah.
Now, he doesn't have to send him a copy to the jail. I don't read the statute that way, but he does have to give him an opportunity to review what he intends to offer in his case in chief. Mr. Henry, at an earlier hearing, was not clear exactly which videos he showed him. He said, I think I showed him the most important ones. What's important to Mr. Henry might not be important to Mr. Trejo. So now he's acting as an attorney.
Did he ask to watch the videos? Did he ask for someone to make arrangements so that he could watch the videos?
So my understanding of the record, unfortunately, he doesn't get any more time. But I do think he acknowledges that Mr. Trejo had contacted Mr. Schwartzer both by telephone and by email, saying, "I'd love an opportunity to review the videos."
Mr. Schwartzer isn't going to sit with him and watch the videos.
Why not? That's my question. Because I'm representing Mr. Trejo and I say, "Hey, Mr. Schwartzer, can I come over and review the videos that you intend to introduce?" He's certainly going to make time for me, isn't he?
He's going to give you a copy.
Well, he is going to give me a copy. But he doesn't have to give me a copy. He can say, "Sure, come on over and we'll review it." I mean, I think that's the way the statute reads. You just have to make available inspection of the evidence you intend to introduce. So the reality is there's no exception. There's no pro per incarceration exception to his discovery obligations. And so if he's representing a pro per, and it's not pleasant being at the jail for hours, I know that. I've done that a lot in 18 years. Mm-hmm. But it is his obligation. And
it's his obligation.
Someone from his office's obligation.
To do more than provide them to the person who was his counsel at the time he gave them.
He can't provide them because it's contraband. So whereas he can provide it to me out of convenience, he can't do that for Mr. Trejo because Mr. Trejo's in jail. So he has a discovery obligation. That's thwarted by the fact that he can't just provide him a disc because he's in jail. So he has to make arrangements to give Mr. Trejo an opportunity to review the evidence he intends to introduce. Now, with respect to harmlessness, the reason I'm saying it's structural is because, one, there's mandatory language in the statute. Two, there's no case law from this jurisdiction and very little from other jurisdictions that directly address that sort of issue. Errors that occur pre-trial can result in reversal. Okay, so it doesn't necessarily mean the trial is perfect, but things happen if I could just finish. Thank
finish
you.
Your thought.
Things that happen pre-trial don't matter if the trial otherwise went pretty well. In this particular case, in reviewing the record, one of the reasons he was frustrated with his attorney was this idea that, like, I can't talk and my attorney is not necessarily saying the things I want him to say in court. So what's structural error? Unquantifiable error. Like, we don't know what would have happened. Like, we can't speculate as to how this would have been different. Would Mr. Trejo have asked to represent himself had he been given an interpreter earlier in the process, a buffer between his attorney, who he obviously has problems with, and someone he can talk to and say, "This, please tell the court this." Now, Mr. Henry might have had legitimate reasons why he's like, "I don't want to bring this up to the court." But the problem is that conflict then sort of poisoned the relationship. So that's why I think, you know, this is structural because it's unquantifiable. It did affect decisions that were made ultimately, which, as Mr. Schwartzer pointed out, probably would have been better for Mr. Trejo to have an attorney in this case. There's no other questions. Thank you very much.
We can all agree on that one. Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your time and the arguments today. This case will stand submitted. We'll be in recess until the next call of the court.